grounding of the car. I'd like to run a twisted pair of 8-gauge, black and red, right back to the battery, with a fuse, of course, through the firewall. So I'm running two leads. And then you said something about the ignition switch being able to turn off the radio. If I'm going through the ignition switch, aren't I then using the wiring from the fuse panel, so to speak, and it's going to have all of those disadvantages? Over to you, Joe.
Some Jap radios put fuses in both power leads, the negative and the positive. If you want to do that, that's what you would have to do. Because you think of it like this, if you ever lose the ground between the battery and the fire, the battery and the engine block, the battery and the frame of the car, it will take the ground to your radio and use that to try to pass a massive amount of current to go back to the starter. It would best definitely melt that wire. So if you want to try that trick, you have to put a fuse on both legs of the power leads.
DC2QAQ. Glenn recognized. Mr. YO first, give us your name. I know I should know it. Go ahead.
Good evening, Dick in the Net. K2YO, the name is Bernie here. If you don't mind throwing a little bit of money at it, meaning like 20 bucks, 30 bucks or so, somewhere in your neighborhood will be a high-end stereo installation shop. For the young folks that have the huge car stereos, those things draw tons of amperage. And so they are experts at getting wires in and around cars. So basically you tell them, I want one end of it here and the other end of it the battery, and please make that happen. And they'll be able to snake it in, make it look real professional, and you know, tell them I want an 8-gauge or a 6 or whatever. They'll probably even have the wire and the connectors and everything. So in the long run, that might actually work out well in that you don't have to buy wire. You won't have to buy the heavy-gauge fuses. They'll have all that stuff and can probably hook you up with it.
Bernie, you think that $20 or $30 will be that kind of an installation? Is it really that inexpensive?
Well, it's just running one wire. You're not asking them to cut the dash and install the radio and do all that kind of stuff. You could. I actually had a place out in Zayas that, not in my current car, but in my previous car. And I want to say it cost me about $100, and they literally hid the radio under the dash, wired, did a custom install of the remote head in the cigarette lighter compartment, did a lot of custom stuff, and it wasn't that expensive. See, they're taking cars apart all the time, so they would immediately know where to go, where it is. They've got the stuff in their shop. Okay, maybe it's $30, but I can't see it being that expensive.
Interesting. Glenn next, and then there's another person who wants to sign. I'll pick you up after Glenn. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a quick comment about the relay. I would never, ever, ever, under any circumstance, put a relay inside the motor compartment if you don't have to, even if they're sealed and anything else. And then there would be extra wires you'd have to run there through to control the relay. If you're going to use a relay, which I do, actually in quite a few places in my car, I put them on the interior side of the car, and I get the power to on off the relay from the fuse box. So basically just the keying power, and you just put a voltmeter on the fuse panel, and when you turn the key on, once it goes hot, that you can usually use that to key up a low power winding on the relay, but that can be done on the inside of the vehicle, and you can fuse accordingly. Back to you, Dick.
I never said anything about putting the relay in the energy compartment.
I see the problem is I have the wrong tone. I'm trying a different way to transmit. Who's the other person who wanted to sign in?
That was me. I just made a comment. I said I never said anything about putting the relay inside the engine compartment. You always put the relay inside the passenger compartment where it's nice and dry.
Very fine, Tony. On the input, I heard all of that. You don't have the PL turned on, so you didn't come through the machine. I heard your comment also, Joe. But, Tony, thank you for that comment. Anyone else?
Glenn is doing with that German call sign.
Tony, you think you turned on the PL. You must not have 136.5 and turned on. Again, I heard you on the input, but you're not coming through the machine. KC2 Quebec.
WA5VJB was an opening.
Oh. WA5VJB. Go ahead, and I'm glad we're hearing you. How did you manage to squeeze through?
Uh, Been trying for close to 2 hours. Sister was never allowed to drop. I poured 6 bags of concrete this week, and that tent in the living room is finally filled in, and doing 6 boards for your friends over at Hop Hog, WA5BJP.
Very fine, Kent. On about 10 occasions, we allowed the machine to thoroughly drop, and then after it dropped, we waited another 2 or 3 seconds of silence. And you're telling me that wasn't long enough for you to get through?
It seemed like, well, I haven't been 100% of the time here, but, yeah, there was always a k or a little psst or something in the background that would reset it.
Okay, that time that you just came back to me, is that the minimum length of time that we have to wait? Because the machine, first of all, the machine takes about 5 seconds to drop. Then we waited another 5 seconds of dead time before you came back. Is that the minimum time that you need? We have to wait 10 seconds to pick you up? Go ahead.
Well, there was a crash in there again that reset it, and I'm not sure how close to real time all this is, but I transmitted as quick as I could.
Okay, I just made a measurement. It took 7 seconds from the time I let go until you came back. Wow. That's a relatively long time. Okay. Sounds like you've got your living room back together. There was another person who wanted to sign in. Who was that? And the person had very little audio. You're going to have to give us a little more audio. Okay, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. I'm hearing you on the input, but not hearing you through the machine. Go ahead. Okay, I think you said you found a big enough hole through the door to go through. Wow. So you wired from the passenger compartment over to the door panel to get into the engine compartment. Is that what you're saying? And is your PL turned on, and is it 136.5? Because you're not coming through the machine, even though I'm hearing you on the input. Go ahead. Okay, that door installation, was that a car like a 99 Toyota Camry? Go ahead. Okay, 2006 Volkswagen Jetta. I hope it's similar enough. But that does give me some extra ideas. You guys have given me a lot of ideas. Okay, anybody else want to discuss anything before Mel goes back to his mailbag? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW. And we got to wait 7 seconds in case somebody else wants to sign in.
W02N.
Wondering how Glenn made up with that German call sign.
W02N, start off with your name and then your question or comment, sir.
Hey, good evening, Dick. I'm just handy talking mobile here. I think we're headed east out to Mastic. And I do have a little electrical question and a little phenomenon that's been going on. To you.
Okay, you're a little bit noisy, but give it a try.
What's to do with electrical wiring in the house, where I originally had installed a dimmer switch, which is basically a potentiometer, takes the 110 voltage, drops it down, and the lights come on, let's say, at half voltage. After about 15 minutes of running it on a half voltage, I'm getting flaring, where the lights like flare almost like the max bright and then go back to dim, max bright, go back to dim. I've had 4 different dimmer switches in there because I figure that's what's wrong, but now I'm thinking maybe I'm getting voltage spikes. Could I get a voltage spike where the voltage would, if it's getting like 60 volts AC, the lamp, the switch is rated at 600 amps, I have 8 60 watt bulbs, 480 watts. I'm drawing off a 600 watt switch, which is one of the popular local manufacturers. But the flaring I'm getting, I'm figuring that the switch was arcing. I heard it in one of the switches arcing, so I swapped out the switch. Let me just drop a second. Swapped the switch out a couple of different switches. still the same problem. Well, I'm saying, could I be getting voltage spikes if I have a loose connection either after the load on the neutral or even on the feed? Is it possible for the voltage to drop to max even though the switch is only feeding it like 60 volts? Is it possible like to jump up to 110 because of a loose connection after the load? WO2N.
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what's going on. I've run into a very similar problem, Bernie. And that is, if you're using one of these dimmers, where, in your case, you're asking for half brilliance, the equivalent of 60 volts, you said. It's really the equivalent of about 80 volts. The thing doesn't really half the voltage. It halves the RMS of the voltage. It is a controlled, silicon-controlled rectifier. In other words, it decides at what phase angle of the 60 cycles is it going to fire. That's what it does. And if you asked for a minimum dim, you're firing very close to zero crossover. If you ask for maximum bright, again, you're firing at very close to zero crossover. The worst case condition for the dimmer circuit is to fire halfway between dim and bright. That's where the voltage is not, in other words, each time it fires on each cycle, it is firing when the voltage is halfway between 0 and the 137 volts peak that the 60 cycle line goes to. Let's say it's at roughly 100 volts. It's got the maximum voltage swing across the device at high current of your four bulbs. The bottom line of this is that you're creating maximum heating of the dimmer circuit. That's why it always gives you the problem some number of minutes downrange after it has experienced heating. It may be rated for 600 watts. The manufacturer is fibbing to you. He's not rated for 600 watts at half brilliance. At half brilliance, your bulbs draw a hell of a lot more current. The inrush current for an incandescent bulb is 15 times higher than normal current when the filament comes up to full temperature. You're running those filaments at a lower temperature. They get a much lower resistance. You're drawing a hell of a lot more current. In my opinion, you're getting a failure of the dimmer circuit itself due to overheating. When it's flashing at you, if by some means you could go in there and find its temperature, I think you're going to find its temperature is sky high. WO2N, K2RIW.
2KEY would have commented on it.
Go ahead, Mel.
The first thing I want to know is the box in the wall where the switch is put into made out of metal, or is it a plastic box over?
Which affects how well it can do cooling. Another very good point there. So, Bernie, if you've got your dimmer mounted in a plastic box where it has very little ability to dump the heat, that also aggravates the hell out of this kind of a circuit. You're using it in the worst possible situation. WO2N, K2RIW.
Thank you, Mel and Dick, for the explanation there. Okay, so you guys are leaning towards the switch. It's in a plastic box. It's been, the first switch was in here about 20 years, no problem. And now over the last year, I've already changed three switches. I've even called the manufacturer and told them about the problem, and I sent them the switch back so they could check it in their lab. And they and then they delivered to me at no charge a brand new switch, and it came by, I think it was FedEx. And I had a brand new switch, no charge. I put it in there, and about a week later, it's talking on me again. So I probably need, I got six, I got eight 60-watt bulbs in there, so it's 480 watts about. And the switch is rated at 600, so I probably need a 1,000 watt rate switch to probably handle that load, even though the original one, I was in there 20 years, never gave me that problem. But it is at max brilliance, yes, at half brilliance, rather. At half, halfway seems to heat. In 15 minutes, she'll be heating up and flaring. But I was going to go, okay, so my original question, so you're saying no as far as, like, getting a voltage spike because of a loose neutral or a bad ground where it would touch and kind of open the circuit for a second and come back. Is it possible the bulb would flare up? And I was thinking no. There's no way I can increase the voltage, feed it with 60 volts, feeding it and have it flare to 100 volts. I'd be creating a free voltage by arcing the neutral or something. I don't think I can make voltage by doing that. So it's back. The problem is back to the switch then, right? It has to be back at the switch.
Yeah, when one of those circuits overheats, Bernie, the timing goes haywire, and you're cooking the daylights out of that circuit. Not only are you using it in the worst possible condition, where even though the manufacturer says it's good for 600 watts, it ain't good for 600 watts, even though you got 480 watts, or 400, whatever it is, 460 watt bulbs, at half brilliance, you're drawing a tremendous amount of current on each one of those firings, and you've got it in a plastic box where it cannot dump the heat. Although it's going to be very difficult to do it, if you could convert that to a metal box, as well as going to the 1,000-volt rating unit, you do that combination and you're going to be belt and suspenders a hell of a lot better off. Back to you, Bernie.
Yep, okay, here we come. We still have another switch in the house that has an external, it's a commercial dimmer that has an external heat sink in it. It's all ripped, and it's actually external, the same profile as the switch. And it's extended about a half inch off the wall with a big heat sink in it. That one hasn't given me problems, but I'm not running 60-watt bulbs, 8 and 400. I'm not running the wattage on. I'm only running about 200 watts on that. And in the kitchen, I got this little chandelier. Well, it's a big chandelier, I guess, that runs 480 watts. But, all right, back to the switch. I'm going to call the manufacturer and throw it back in his lap, see what he says. He's one of the big ones out here, and see what he has to say about it. It's the low end of the line, but it's rated for 600, and it just can't handle that load. It is at half voltage here. Okay, I don't want to hold it anymore. I think we went over it, and it's back to the switch. It's not a grounding or a neutral. I was ready to take the panel off and look for a loose neutral or something going back at this point, or the connections where all 8 bulbs are connected around a scotch lock or up in the ceiling where it's connected there, thinking, you know, somewhere that could have building resistance. But I know, see, at full brilliance, there's no problem. Like you said, it's only at the half load. But going back to a loose connector is not going to increase your voltage. If anything, it would just flare back to half. You're not going to be able to increase its voltage. So, all right, Dick, thank you very much. Enjoy listening to the net. It's always educational. WO2N, 73. I'll be listening out.
PC2QIQ.
PC2UPP with a comment.
Okay, Glenn and UPP both. Bernie, are you in Mastic in your automobile right now? Go ahead.
I'm on a LIE headed eastbound, just crossing 41, 106 on the expressway, about 5 watts on a handy talking.
Very good. You're coming through quite well. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick comment with that switch is that, you know, an interesting thing is that, you know, by saying that when it's on full intensity, when it's turned all the way up, you're not seeing any flickering, that almost kind of rules out that it's a issue with the wiring to the lights themselves, because that's the full power position for the wiring and for the lights. When you're dimming it down is when you're going to be getting the less power to the light bulbs, but more power on the power control itself. So what's kind of interesting is if you wanted to prove it to yourself, was it wiring or anything else, would be to take the dimmer out for a while, replace it with a switch temporarily, and just see if at full intensity it ever gives you any flickering or any trouble over time. If it doesn't, you really do know it's the switch then. I mean, it's the dimmer itself. And as far as the dimmers go, with the ratings on them, you have to realize, too, that those are VA ratings. You know, it's volts times amps, not necessarily, you know, power directly. So you could have some situations where actually the VA with the dimmer could be a little bit higher than 600 watts, even with 480 watts worth of light bulbs. Back over to you, Dick, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, but think about this, Glenn. In order for him to get half brilliance, he is firing the equivalent of a silicon-controlled rectifier before it hits maximum voltage, or when it's on the decay from maximum voltage. So he's firing in the time domain so that the RMS is half brilliance, even though once it fires, it's either full on or full off. But he's firing it at maximum voltage drop across the device at the instant it goes into the conduct mode. In order for him to get flashing of the light, which means he's now getting full brilliance, the only way he can be getting full brilliance is for the time domain out of the dimmer to be longer. The only way the timing can be longer is it's running hot and it's losing its timing capability. I mean, there's no way that the dimmer could be firing at the time it normally fires and his light bulbs get more voltage over a longer period of time. You see where I'm going? I can't believe there's any kind of miswiring that can give him extra voltage to his bulbs. Over to you for a comment on that one, Glenn.
Absolutely, Dick. I completely agree. And one of the failure modes of these types of SCRs in the overheating is they don't turn off. Actually, one of the things that happens as they overheat, the first thing that you start losing is the gate control, and it will stay on. And then once it's in the on position all the time, it's not going to heat up as much. When it cools down, then it will go back into the other mode, and thus the flickering. Back over to you, Dick, KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, it looks to me like we pinned it down. Over to you, Mike, KC2, UPP.
The only comment I wanted to make, I am an electrician, and I would never put 480 watts on a 60-watt dimmer. That's max, it really is. You're only supposed to go 80%. If I was up in the neighborhood of 480 watts, I would automatically go up to a 1,000-watt dimmer. Back to you.
And particularly if he's going to be using it a lot of hours at half dim, and also mounting it without a great big heat sink, and mounting it inside of a plastic box. That's the worst case combination. The poor thing is running hot, maximum heat, and it's inside of something that's maximum insulated. Other than that, it's in good condition. So regardless of what the manufacturer says, I think in the great big picture of the laws of physics here, Bernie, you've been pushing the laws of physics on this one. Now that we understand it, you need more heat sinking and a bigger unit, or friendlier light bulbs. Once you flip over to Glenn's high-intensity light-emitting diodes, all of this problem's going to go away. Isn't that true, Glenn?
Absolutely, but you got to get the color right for the living room first. That might take a little while, but yeah, the LEDs are going to be everywhere. Back over to you, to KC2QIQ.
Now, tell me what happens to the color that I get out of light-emitting diodes when I put them onto a dimmer. I guess if I'm adjusting them in the time domain, which will give me the apparent dimness as far as my eye is concerned, as long as the flicker rate is fast enough, but yet when they're on, they're getting full voltage, I guess I would be getting normal chromaticity. I'm a little bit afraid that if I take a light-emitting diode and feed it a lower amount of current from a constant current generator, I might get a slightly different color out of it. Is that true?
Oh, I kind of doubt it, Dick. From what I've seen so far from most of the scans that we've run on light-emitting diodes and actually measuring luminescence and over frequency and wavelength, what we've seen is that generally between the lenses on them and the way that the material's cut and pretty much most of the way the structure is made right now with these high-intensity ones, that the frequency shift with voltage and, well, actually I should really say current through the LED really does very, very little to the color spectrum. It'll shift a little bit, but nothing noticeable to the eye. Back over to you, K2RAW, KC2QIQ.
Leaving lots of time in there just in case. So you're saying the wavelength of light coming out changes very little when I ask for less brilliance by putting in less current from a constant current generator. And even if there was a shift in wavelength coming out of the lighting emitting diode, I could get around that by giving it full voltage when I give it voltage, but only giving it for a shorter period of time. Out of curiosity, the actual voltage that you put into the lighting emitting diodes, I'm guessing it's a constant current generator, and you're keeping the current constant throughout most of the 60 cycle waveform is my guess, and that if you want dimness, you just do pulse duration modulation at a high enough frequency rate that I don't see flicker. Is that the way dimming takes place with light emitting diodes? Go ahead.
Pretty much. There's a couple of techniques that can be used. One is you can use DC and basically just reduce the current. That's one method. The other method would be you can rectify 60 cycles, and even 60 cycles, you're going to have a conduction angle, and it's going to be pulsing on and off at 60 cycles, but the eye really doesn't detect 60-cycle pulsing. So your eye's going to see something less than that. So you really won't see it unless something else is flickering in the room at the same time, and then you get some beat frequency in between. Then you'll see some kind of like pulsing action. Really don't see a problem there. You can also use high frequency, as you mentioned before, and switch it and dim it that way. There's quite a few different methods of doing it, but certainly even just by using a DC source and reducing the current. If you look at these graphs for the luminescence of the LED over its frequency range, it's pretty high Q-dec, and you'd be amazed at how even by changing the current over a pretty wide range, from say like 100 lumen output down to 25 lumen output, that the Q is pretty high. It shifts a little bit, but nothing that you would notice to the eye. Back over to you, Dick.
Also, if I'm feeding it with a full wave rectified power supply, and if I'm not filtering it, wouldn't I be getting 120 pulses per second, not 60?
Yes, that's correct, Dick.
Okay, I think the average human eye is not going to see any kind of flicker effect at 120 pulses per second, which is what you also get out of fluorescent lighting. And I think there was some fluorescent lighting in the old days where you have two bulbs in the fixture and the two bulbs are running slightly out of phase with each other, which even makes the flicker less than that. I wonder if that's true. Did they ever run fluorescent bulbs slightly out of phase with each other? Looks like nobody's sure on that one. I have on a number of occasions put my hand in front of a fluorescent bulb and wave my fingers back and forth real fast, and you do see a stroboscopic effect of your fingers in front of the fluorescent bulb, letting you know that there are 120 pulses per second of light coming out of the machine. What would you know? We got a little bit of time left. Maybe you can go to another one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Very interesting. Yeah, I used to do that trick with the kids with the television set. Take their fingers and go like this. Look your fingers in front of the TV set and you see the black line. So, show them that how the TV, basically the picture, was put together. What came up today on the 10-meter net is a new controversy again that you happen to hear about this business again that's going to a major court case again about removal of antennas near schools, Dick, if this is going to be a law that's going to be passed over.
Yeah, it's happened out here in Suffolk County and in Nassau County on a couple of occasions. Some of those cases are ongoing right now, and it's foolish. In other words, somewhere within eyesight of a school, there is a cell tower, and somebody thinks that it's going to be giving the kids radio frequency biohazard problems. Those parents fail to realize that the cell phone against your head is giving you 1 million times more RF energy into your body than if you lived directly next door on the adjacent piece of property to a cell phone base station. That's the way inverse square law works. You can't get any closer than about 100 feet from that antenna, and you're even at the wrong angle to not even be in the peak of the beam of the antenna from the cell site base station. But that cell phone against your head, what the manufacturers have done to try to limit the liability is they have switched the antenna. The antenna used to be a little monopole coming out of the back, the top of the cell phone, and it would stick up above your ear. They now have put the antenna down by the microphone at the bottom of the radio so that it's now lighting up your chin instead of lighting up your head. And they think that that's going to limit the liability. It's a somewhat futile effort. It gives them a compromise in radio performance, but that's what they've done. But that cell phone near your head, I mean, if these parents were really being serious, they would never, never let their child use a cell phone. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I think that just some of it is really a little bit, it's like a witch hunt almost, because even if you think about it, the same people who are complaining about this and are worried about their children, they bring them to the dentist once, twice a year, minimum, and they sit in a chair where they put a big lead blanket over their child. They point the X-ray machine right at their head and snap it. But of course, before they do that, everyone leaves the room and they blast that on them, and then they come back in, take the lead blanket off. boy, if they're not worried about X-rays, for heaven's sakes, the little bit of possible, you know, radiated energy coming up the cell tower is minuscule by comparison. It's crazy.
And the majority of the problem is a vocabulary problem. Had we called it radio signaling, radio transmission, radio propagation, had we called it any of those words instead of RF radiation, it's that word radiation, it's an emotional word. There is a huge difference between nuclear radiation, X-ray radiation, and radio signaling. There's a huge difference. But because there's a commonality of the word, that's an emotional word, and boy, that's creating a huge problem. The average cell phone company has to invest more than $250,000 in legal fees in order to get permits in a town to put up a cell phone base station. And that goes on over and over again. Craziness. K2KEY, K2RW, tell us more about this case, Mel. What town is it taking place in?
Hawaii.
Mel first, and then we'll pick up Joe. Go ahead, Mel.
I'm going to let it drop just in case Kent wants to get in. Where is it? I wish Howie was on frequency. He's the one who told me about it. He said he saw it on the news broadcast on television, one of the news programs. And I don't know. Maybe there's somebody on frequency that does know where exactly where this hullabaloo is going, because they're claiming that some studies have showed that the increase in childhood autism is being contributed to by cell phone towers or cell phone and themselves. I don't know exactly, but I understood from what Howie says. He was mentioned that to me earlier, but I guess he had to go to sleep or whatever. But all right, I'll toss it out to the net. Maybe somebody can give you more info.
WHCDL.
Yes, it's created by ultrasound imaging. Talking about that, how is the ultrasound education, Dick?
Yeah, turns out that Kent was in there just as you started transmitting, Mel. Even though you waited 7 seconds, we have to wait 9 seconds. First of all, Kent, we're going to wait and see what you've got to say about this, and then we're going to pick up all the other guys. Go ahead, Kent. WA5VJB, we're going to give you one more chance.
There we go. I was trying to click in. It wasn't letting me for some reason. Dick, an LED can be used as a Zener diode. So the voltage drop of them is quite constant. And across the junction itself, pretty much independent of current. So the electrons are always falling the same number of electron volts. You're always getting pretty much the same wavelength photons, with a little noise in there. The white, and especially the infrared that we've worked with, are very non-linear. You double the current, you get a lot more than twice as much luminance. So the high-efficiency infrared illumination systems and the high-efficiency white illumination systems are only running the diodes at about a 2% duty factor and pulsing the bejeebies out of them for those 2 seconds for the amount of current. And it's all being controlled by one little 8-pin chip. And so they're pulsing them pretty fast, pretty hard to get the high efficiency. I've got about 10 LED light bulbs here in this place, and it's amazing. I have a little chandelier sitting up there with five light bulbs in it, illuminating pretty much the living room, and it's pulling the same amount of power as one Christmas tree light. K2RIW, WA5DJB.
Don, interesting. Are the super high efficiency bulbs you've worked with, Glenn, doing it that way? He makes it sound like it's a huge pulse of current with only a few percent duty factor in order to run them at high efficiency. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That's Dick. Am I making the machine on the HD?
Yes, you are.
Great. Yeah, that's one of the methods. Certainly, there's different ways of dimming them, and that's a very high-efficiency way of dimming them. Works very, very well. But keep in mind, too, that the efficiency of the LED is really just a function of the LED. If you were just to run it with a DC power supply and look at the amount of luminescence per unit of power that they're using, they're extremely more efficient by a factor of at least, I would say at least 3-to-1 minimum better than the best incandescent bulb that you could find. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Is there a tron now on? Do I need a PL tone?
Yes, you're coming through, and your PL tone is proper. Glenn, according to what Kent was telling us just now, the super high efficiency is coming from a large pulse of current. In other words, as you increase the current, the lumens per milliampere or lumens per watt increases, but you can't run them continuously that way for fear of overheating them. So he said there's a very inexpensive little integrated circuit chip that is putting a huge pulse of current through the light-emitting diodes to get the high efficiency, but doing it with a low duty factor so as not to burn the bulb out. And I'm wondering, does the bulb still give you the 250,000 hours of life when you run it in that mode? Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, it does. As a matter of fact, whether you pulse it or do just about anything to it, there's very, very little damage or anything that's going to degrade the life of the LED by doing that. As long as you don't exceed the maximum, how should I say, the maximum ratings of the LED. So when you're looking at the ratings of the LED, there's a temperature rating maximum, there's a voltage rating maximum, and a current rating maximum. Mainly the current and temperature are the really two key ratings for the LED. Now, the funny part about that is as long as you don't exceed those, now, what can happen sometimes is if people are really trying to push the LED, what they can do is instead of putting DC directly into the bulb, they're using like a 120 hertz rectified, 60 cycle rectified giving you 120 hertz output. What can happen is that you're trying to get the maximum luminescence, so you're allowing the peak to run above the average DC level, and that will increase the peak dissipation. That could reduce the light, but not going to the maximum DC level and then reducing the duty cycle in order to dim the bulb. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, after I pick up Alex's comment, I'm going to go back to Kent and ask him another question about this. Alex, you had a comment on all this. And then N2NNU, K2RIW.
I was kind of thinking that autism is attributed nowadays to the ultrasonic imaging that they're doing to the children. But anyway, I was wondering how you're doing, how is your ultrasonic education going, Dick?
WHSCDL.
Okay, I'll get to that in a minute. Go ahead, Andy.
I'm just curious, were you hearing me before? Because I broke in a few times.
I heard you at least once before break in, and I'm forgetful, and I didn't go back to you when I should have. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, because I just wanted to know if this radio was working. I'm not sure. Good evening. I just turned it on, but I got to get to work tomorrow, so I got to go. I turned it on when Mel was talking about something about cell phones. I got caught the gist of it. There was a case in the news this past week, and it was over in Staten Island at a school. Is that the one you're talking about, where they were complaining that the school is very close to a cell tower? In fact, not only that, but there's on the school itself are antennas for a cell site. And there was a hearing because they're thinking that the kids, and I think they have autism or something of that effect, are being affected by the radiation from the cell tower, and they're making a complaint about it. That was in the news in Staten Island. Is that, it was over on Huguenot, which is on the west side of Staten Island. Is that the location you were talking about? I just wanted to clarify that.
I'll bet you that's the case. Go ahead, Mel.
I believe that's it. Howie mentioned it, and I know it was somewhere in the local New York five boroughs area, so I assume that's it, especially you said that they mentioned autism. That was really their major concern, that the increase, for some reason, we are seeing a tremendous increase in autism in children. It was almost an unknown type of condition not too many years ago, and now has come forefront, Dick, over.
And to blame that on cell phones is a long shot. As Alex was telling us, we now use a lot more ultrasound imaging practices on our children. We use quite a bit more x-rays on dentals. Diet has changed an awful lot because of fast foods, high sodium diet. A lot of high fructose corn syrup is in every one of the sodas that kids are drinking. They're drinking tremendous amounts of soft drinks that they think are safe. I'm not convinced that they are. There's a darn many environmental things that are changing. For somebody to choose this particular one because it has that emotional word radiation, I think is an extremely long shot. But because that subject is as emotional as it is, although it's unfair, I think there's a darn good chance that the families will win their case and that antenna is going to be removed, even though there was an FCC ruling saying that you cannot deny the sighting of a cell phone base station based on the perceived risk of a radio frequency biohazard. Communication Act of 1996, I think, essentially says that. So they're going to have to find some other excuse. In other words, they'll claim that this is it's affecting the aesthetics of the neighborhood and changing property values, and they'll win on that one. They'll lose, though, on radio frequency biohazard, I believe. Let's see if anyone's got any comments on that one. And if we want to wait for Kent to come through, Andy, if you're still listening, we discovered that we have to drop the repeater. The repeater has to go dead, silent, for something like 6 or 7 separate seconds before Kent is able to get through on the IRLP. K2LIW listening.
I'll make a comment about that.
Yeah, go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, there's been some complaints because we're keying up too quickly, including myself. You know, I have to remember that IRLP is not a full duplex system. It's one way. And it takes a few seconds. I'm not sure exactly how many seconds for the system, the IRLP node, or system, I should say, to react. So, because there was one of the reflectors, somebody was saying that they were trying to get in, and there was just too many key-ups. So, even though I have not made any tests on it, eventually I'll get an IMLP node set up for myself, and I'll be able to experiment. But I haven't. All right, just one more thing before I go. it is interesting how they're complaining and blaming cell towers to cause this problem, which, of course, you and I don't think it's true. Like, I know it's not true. But what about all these kids that have cell phones that are using cell phones right up to their ear that's emitting radiation right there? How come they don't complain about that? You know, the parents can give a child a cell phone, and most kids, even in their early teens, and even younger, have cell phones that they carry in an emergency. I know my 12-year-old niece has her own cell phone. And there's no complaints about that at the cell towers. So you figure that one out.
Okay, let me just say to you guys that, first of all, Kent is talking on Echolink. The IRLP requires 2 seconds. Echolink requires a tail of Selden to drop before it'll even think about letting him transmit. So give the Echolink about 3.5 to 4 seconds, plus the second on the tail, plus 2 seconds for the IRLP, and then you know what happens. K2Z.
It's a simple solution.
Yeah, we did a little bit of timing before, and Kent is not able to get in there until after I let go of the push to talk. We wait approximately 8 seconds before he can come back. Alex, what do you think the solution is?
Solution is, it's called Skype. Use Skype for this purpose.
Okay, let's wait the 8 seconds and see if Kent's got comments on all of the above.
There we go. Now we got full audio. interesting. In years gone by, you had kids with autism, and they just referred to them as being mentally retarded. You had kids with ADHD, and we just simply called them discipline problems. I think perhaps the best example you can use is, let's see, when did they first start transmitting from the Empire State Building? Was it 1938 or 1939? So you have had television transmitters on top of the Empire State Building running for 70 years. You have had people living in those upper floors all that time. So we're talking RF levels, which are thousands of times higher than what you would get from a cell tower down the street. And people have been living in those for 70 years. And if there was a cluster of ingrown toenails caused by RF exposure, I think we would have known it. K2RIW, WA5BKB.
Interesting comment. These parents all do not realize what Andy was saying, that we all give our kids cell phones. In the United Kingdom, there is a strong recommendation by the Radio Society of Great Britain not to let a five-year-old child talk to grandma over the cell phone, because it may not be safe for a five-year-old child. The cell phone itself, because it is so close to the head, is giving you approximately 1 million times more radio energy into your body than if you lived directly next door to the cell phone base station, as close as you can possibly get. So for that school nearby, where you can look out the window and see the cell phone base station, for that to be the cause, well, the psychology of what's going on here is that word radiation, the emotional word, and when you look at the cell phone base station antenna system, it's a great big chunk of hardware. In some cases, 120 feet high, with a great big Christmas tree of a zillion antennas on top. It looks ominous. It's big. Whereas a little bitty cell phone you whip out of your pocket and put it against your head, it is small. It happens to get hot in your hand, but you ignore that also. This is a strong misunderstanding of some basic physics. But very little of this information we are now all discussing is really going to get into that courtroom and be part of that decision. That's the sad state of affairs. So I guess, who is it that brought to our attention the fact that this occurred in Staten Island? I guess it was you, Andy. What is the current status of the case? Has the first hearing taken place, and the zoning board, or the Board of Zoning Appeals in the Staten Island, is in the decision mode, or are there going to be more hearings of what you know about? WA2CDL, if you're still there, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm here, and then I'm going to go. It's 12 o'clock. Peter's going to shut off in a second here. I'll make it quick. There was one hearing, and that's what was reported in the news. It was during that hearing that people were complaining. So I don't know what the outcome of that hearing is. I'm not sure if there'll be any more hearings. Let me do it back to you, because I got 12 o'clock here. WA2CDL.
I've got 1 minute, too. This was TechNet number
1,012 a.m.
1,239 of the series. 73, you all, by night, be kind to each other. And Mel, for your call.
Tonight at 8:30, net, tonight.
I heard Mel on the input. He said goodnight, all. Be kind to each other. See you guys down the line. K2LAW and Mel, K2KEY, we're clear.
Me now. We need more power, but we don't.
Eric, you still listening? K2EJ, WHCDL. Hello? I can't go in on the east input because I can't make it from here at this time. But, Eric, you still there?
Yeah, can you hear me, Andy? 185.
Yeah, I hear you.
Copy everybody, I'm on the east link with a handy talking WO2N.
Yeah, first of all, Eric, there's a meeting this Tuesday. The meeting was not Wednesday, it's this Tuesday, if you didn't know that, just to let you know, because of the holiday, Passover. I'm going to be at the meeting. Are you going to be there?
Good morning. The time is 12:02 a.m.
Okay. You can hear me now, right, Andy?
Yes, the repeater is back on. Yeah, I want to clear this up because there's no reason for one repeater to go off. The west goes off and the east does not. And it's got to be either both or all, but not one or the other.
Well, you know, let's put it this way. You're going to have, like, direct conversations between the two repeaters, but so what? I don't even know why we bother to turn it off anyway.
Well, that's what I want to mention. I want to see if I can correct that. I wanted to mention the meeting before I forget. The meeting is Tuesday, not Wednesday.
The general meeting?
Yes, because Passover is Wednesday night.
That's a good reason.
Right, so I just want to let you know in case you didn't know about it. So I'll be there Tuesday.
Okay. If I don't catch you before, actually I'm going to be at the... We start begging again tomorrow.
Reflector,
so.
9.
I'll be there all
two,
evening.
6, link clear.
If you want to bring it with you and I'll meet you somewhere on your way home, that is if you come up a little bit towards me, and we could do that, or I'll just wait until Tuesday. It doesn't seem to be anybody but me that's in a hurry.
Right. No, there's really no rush on it, because it's only that. I got to get my car fixed tomorrow. I still didn't get the part. And I'm annoyed at that. But Tuesday, I'll be at the meeting. I'll bring it. So I'll see you then.
All right. Very good. And then we'll have 1.2 gig at some point. I put together a little mixer so I could see it on the service monitor that I work. But I still want a radio.
Okay. While you were talking, the node 5126 cleared between the repeaters. Yeah, I want to find out. There's no reason to have this go off and the other one stay on. It's no reason for that. All right, I got to go to work, so I got to sign out.
All right, Andy, good night. I turn this back off. W-H-U-C-D, LK-2J, as soon as we stop talking, it will automatically reconnect.
Okay. I'll talk to you later. Talk to you tomorrow. W-H-U-C-D, LK, see you later.
W-H-U-C-D, LK, 2J.
The time is 12:05 a.m., 73, and good night from the W2BL repeater.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the New England Reflector 912.
Channel 6. The time is 1:23 a.m., 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Good morning. The time is 2 a.m.
Net tonight at 8:30. Net tonight at 8:30.
Are you on there, Richard?